Great. Before I get started, I'd like to thank Sabrina for the opportunity to speak. So I'm Roland. I'm a postdoc here in the mathematical physics group. But recently I've been doing some things which will hopefully be interesting to some of you in the audience. And I realized just now, as it appeared on the screen, that of course it isn't actually January 2022. Bit of a minor screw up there, but right, okay, so without further ado, let's get started. So in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of progress in our understanding of quantum self-Drew-Young-Mills theory and some related quantum field theories using twister methods. So I guess this was really initiated by Kevin in this paper in 2021, and then there are a couple of papers by Kevin and Natalie last year, and then another one with Atul on holography. And these works are kind of closely related to developments in celestial holography. And of course, there's a vast literature on celestial holography. Here I've just put three of the papers that will be most relevant for what I'm talking about today. But I'm sure that there are probably many others that would be relevant. And today I'm going to be discussing the application of similar sort of twister methods in the context of self-dual gravity. And it's based on these, mostly on this first work, but there's also some stuff from this other paper I wrote with Atul and Dave. Okay, I want to start by just reviewing some of this work on self-Drew-Young-Mills theory, because I think it will help motivate some of the things that I do in the context of self-dual gravity. So, self-Drew-Young-Mills equations are defined on equations for a connection on a principal G bundle over a Riemannian manifold. Okay. So in this talk, I'm going to be a bit fast and loose with reality conditions. When in doubt, I might as well be on a Riemannian manifold, although, of course, there can't really be amplitudes in Euclidean signature. So if to get actual scattering amplitudes with sensible reality conditions, we should really work in plus plus minus minus signature. But actually, it turns out most of the things we'll be concerned with will end up being rational. So it doesn't really matter what signature we work in. They just analytically continue meromorphically. So the self-Drew-Young-Mills equations just tell us that the curvature of this connection is self-dual. And of course, the self-Drew-Young-Mills equations imply the full Young-Mills equations. If we just hit the left-hand side with the gauge covariant derivative, on the left-hand side, we get the Bianchi identity, and the right-hand side, we get the Young-Mills equations. And it's possible to write down an action for the self-Drew-Young-Mills equations, where we just impose them with a Lagrange multiplier. So here, this field B, it's this minus here means that it's anti-self-dual. So in the action, it will just pick up the anti-self-dual part of F. And when I vary it, it will just impose that F is anti-self-dual. And we can use this to define self-Drew-Young-Mills as a perturbative field theory. OK, so the self-Drew-Young-Mills equations are integrable, or at least they are, on a conformally half-flat background, but in this context, I think we might as well take it to be a flat R4. And their solutions admit the action, at least in a formal sense, of an infinite dimensional hidden symmetry algebra. And there have been a few works in which this kind of thing appears in various different guises and sometimes in various subgroups. But recently, it's sort of been identified as the chiral algebra of positive helicity asymptotic symmetries which arise from soft theorems in Young-Mills. And this is in the context of celestial holography. And I'm going to call this thing V self-Drew-Young-Mills. So as a Lie algebra, it consists of, so here, this notation means that I've got polynomials in these two variables, V1 dot and V2 dot, a Laurent series in Z, and the coefficients live in my Lie algebra. We can think of this sort of the Laurent series as being sort of a mode expansion of some chiral algebra. And so thinking of this thing as a chiral algebra, it's generated by these objects. So there's a gauge index. These M and N are kind of the basis of polynomials. And so these are just non-negative integers. And then the defining APEs are just basically a level zero Kac-Moody algebra. 1 over z is just telling us it's the loop algebra of some the algebra, and then I just add these non-negative integers. And I think this is sometimes called the S-algebra in the context of celestial holography. Okay, so this OPE describes the singularity in a Yang-Mills tree amplitude as two positive velocity gluons become collinear, or rather the null momenta on those legs become collinear. And it also actually describes the collinear singularities of one-loop amplitudes in self-dual Yang-Mills. And actually, self-dual Yang-Mills theory is one-loop exact, and so the only amplitudes, the only non-trivial amplitudes in self-dual Yang-Mills are one-loop amplitudes. In fact, all the trees vanish as well. And if you take, so they've all got positive velocity external gluons, and if I take the null momenta become collinear, I'll find that the singularity I get is precisely described basically by the tree splitting amplitude, which is encoded in this OPE. However, recently, Kevin and Natalie argue that sort of an extended version of this algebra, which has got this celestial chiral algebra V self-dual Yang-Mills and a kind of copy of its adjoint, describe the collinear limits or collinear singularities of form factors in self-dual Yang-Mills. So I'm going to explain what a form factor is in just a second. But let me just first explain what this V tilde means. So I just add a bunch more generators, which have got a little tilde on top of them. Hopefully that's visible. So these are different generators. And when I hit them with a J, I just get sort of the same OPE as I would have got if two J's collided with one another. And importantly, the J tildes have trivial OPEs among themselves. Okay. All right. So a form factor is an amplitude that in the presence of a local operator. So we just insert a local operator and we're only allowed to do it once. So here are two examples of form factors. This is, of course, a tree form factor, and this is a one loop form factor. A particularly interesting example of a local operator you might consider is this B squared operator. Here, kappa inverse is the inverse of the Killing form. And the reason this is particularly interesting is if you were to add it to the action of self-dual Yang-Mills, if you integrated it over space and then you added it to the action, that would deform you to full Yang-Mills. And so in particular, the form factors of this local operator contribute, or in some cases just are, amplitudes in full Yang-Mills. And so for example, this form factor contributes to the 4-point MHV amplitude, and this form factor contributes to the 1 minus 5-point amplitude at one loop. So if we look at these two legs on the left here, we can see that it's possible to have positive and negative external, helicity external gluons. If we take their momenta to become collinear, we'll find that this propagator here blows up, and that singularity in the amplitude is described by the OPE on previous page. And here you can see the importance of having these negative, introducing these J tildes. It's precisely because in form factors, you can have negative helicity external legs. So that's not true of the amplitudes in self-dual Yang-Mills, aside from maybe the 3-point amplitude, which is kind of, well, in Lorentzian signature, that doesn't appear anyway. So it's precisely because we're allowing ourselves to introduce a local operator that we need to include the possibility of having negative helicity external legs.
Is there a bound on how many negative you can have?
Is there a
bound on how many negative legs you can have?
Well, I guess it depends on what operator you introduce. For this single O, I guess I'm pretty sure there'll always be, if you just insert this once, you'll just at tree level, you'll get just the MHVs, so two minuses. At one loop, you'll get one minus, and at two loop, you'll get all plus. Okay. So the second diagram I've illustrated, because you can see if this positive helicity gluon, and this positive helicity gluon, if their null momenta become collinear, this propagator will blow up. And in fact, this loop integral will also diverge. And you can see that this changes the collinear behavior of this form factor at one loop. So this couldn't happen at tree level. And what this is telling us is that the chiral algebra is being deformed. And I want to emphasize again that that doesn't happen. That wouldn't happen in just self-dual Yang-Mills. It's precisely because we've introduced a local operator. So that can happen. So Kevin and Natalie showed that the correction that this introduces doesn't lead to a consistent chiral algebra. So it simply doesn't exist. And they found that the source of the failure was the all plus amplitudes. And to get a consistent chiral algebra, you needed to cancel them. So I'm going to go into more detail about all this stuff in the context of self-dual gravity. I'm just going through this to motivate some of the things I'll do. So we'll see this a bit more explicitly in the gravity case shortly. So then finally, they show that there's a correspondence between local operators and conformal blocks. So a local operator, so by which I mean a gauge invariant local operator in self-dual Yang-Mills, corresponds to, so here conformal block refers to a consistent way of assigning a number to a correlation function, product of, say, J's and J tildes. And then an amplitude in the presence of that local operator, okay, an amplitude in the presence of that local operator, so a form factor, will then just be obtained by evaluating the correlator of, say it's got two negative elasticity external legs, five positive, you stick in two J tildes, five J's, and then you evaluate the correlator in the corresponding conformal block. All right, okay, that's all I wanted to say about self-dual Yang-Mills. Let's move on to self-dual Einstein gravity. So first of all, I just wanted to motivate why this is an interesting thing to consider. Hopefully you believe that 4D Einstein gravity is interesting, and it's also challenging. At least its amplitudes can be very complicated. They can have lots of nasty features, of course, UV divergences, IR divergences, among other things. Self-dual Einstein gravity is much less interesting, but it's also much less challenging because it's classically integrable, it's one loop exact, and it's finite. I mean, if you look at its amplitudes, just like self-dual Yang-Mills, it will only have one loop or plus amplitudes, and all but the three-point tree amplitude vanish. So it's a much, much less interesting theory, but it's much, much easier to understand. However, it does retain some of the important features of Einstein gravity. It's four-dimensional, and it has propagating degrees of freedom. And most importantly, it can be deformed to get to full Einstein gravity. And we can exploit the simplicity of the self-dual sector to understand that deformation. So what is self-dual Einstein gravity? Again, mostly during this talk, I'm going to be a bit vague about reality conditions. But for now, this might as well be in Riemannian or Euclidean signature. So if we've got a metric on a four-dimensional manifold M, the self-dual vacuum Einstein equations just tell us that the Weyl tensor is self-dual and the Ricci tensor vanishes. So I should say throughout this talk, I'm going to assume that there's vanishing cosmological constant. It would probably be interesting to consider the possibility of having a non-vanishing cosmological constant, but that can wait for time. So of course, the vanishing of the Ricci tensor, that is just the Einstein equation. And this this is sometimes called the conformally half-flat condition. This is basically what makes it integrable. It can be written in a slightly different way if we introduced Weierbinds. I don't think this should be clear from these equations. This is equivalent. But I think it's easier to understand where this comes from if we think about it at the level of the action. So there's the self-dual Palatini action is an action for full general relativity, at least perturbatively. So this is an unfortunate naming convention. The self-dual here really refers to the fact that it's defined using only half of the spin connection. It's an action for full gravity, at least up to a topological term, which is the Nyaya-Yan term, and it differs from the tetradic Palatini action. We can get an action for self-dual gravity by taking the weak coupling limit, where this term disappears. And hopefully it's clear that if I vary this anti-self-dual part of the spin connection, it will just impose the self-dual Yang-Mills equations in this form as a Lagrange multiplier. And then if we work in perturbation theory around flat space, we can define self-dual Einstein gravity as a perturbative quantum field theory. Now, just like as was the case for the self-dual Yang-Mills equations, the self-dual vacuum Einstein equations are integrable. And one consequence of this is that they have an infinite dimensional hidden symmetry algebra or symmetry group. And this has recently appeared in the context of the positive velocity asymptotic symmetries which arise from soft theorems. I think this is the thing people sometimes call W1 plus infinity. So it's really the loop algebra of the Lie algebra of Hamiltonian vector fields on C squared. And this object, ham t squared, is very closely related to w1 plus infinity. It's just a couple of steps away. And some of the differences are going to be important. So that's why I wanted to
just distinguish it in this context.
So as we saw in the case of self-dual Young-Mills, the collinear singularities of the one loop all plus amplitudes, which are the only non-trivials in self-dual gravity, are also described by this chiral algebra. They're not deformed. So in this sense, the celestial chiral algebra of self-dual gravity is not deformed at the quantum level. But what we'll find is that there's an analogous object to this extended version found by Kevin and Natalie in the gravitational case as well.
Okay.
So I'll write this as V SDGR. This L just tells me it's the loop algebra of, and then this ham C squared is the Lie algebra of Hamiltonian vector fields on C squared. I should say, when I say Hamiltonian vector fields on C squared, I mean C squared with its standard holomorphic symplectic structure. So if I have my two holomorphic coordinates are x and y, it's just dx wedged dy. So as a chiral algebra, this is generated by these WMN generators, where m and n are non-negative integers, and the OPEs just take this form. And this PS minus QR are just the structure constants of the Lie algebra of Hamilton C squared. So already, there are some things we can learn about this algebra. So first of all, W00 is central. It's got trivial OPEs with everything. We could, in fact, throw it away from the algebra without we could quotient by it, I suppose, and it would be harmless. But it's convenient to keep it for understanding deformations later on. W10 and W01, when interpreted as asymptotic symmetries, correspond to supertranslations. And these are kind of very, very important because they're the only generators in the algebra which can lower P plus Q or M plus N when they act on another generator. You can see that we sort of lower by one and then we add one either in P or Q, say, if this P plus Q was one. And then finally, we have these three generators which generate an SL2 current algebra at level zero. And in fact, all of these things together form a sub-chiral algebra of this chiral algebra. And that's going to be really important. So it turns out combining this SL2C with the symmetry you get from the supertranslations is very, very constraining. It restricts any deformations to the chiral algebra a great deal. So to understand how this describes the collinear singularities of the graviton amplitudes, it's useful to organize them into hard generating functions. So we identify, we view Z as an inhomogeneous coordinate on the Riemann sphere, and we can introduce this inhomogeneous coordinate, which is a left-handed spinner, and I've just rescaled its second component to be one. And then we introduce some auxiliary right-handed spinner, lambda tilde, and we form this generating function. So if you rewrite the OPE on the previous page in terms of this generating function, you'll find that it takes this form, where the square bracket 1, 2 is sort of the SL2C invariant combination I can build from the lambda tildes, and the angle brackets is the SL2 invariant combination I can build from these lambdas. And if I identify this lambda tilde, the right-handed lambda tilde, and the left-handed lambda as spinner helicity variables for a null momenta, then we can identify this object as the tree graviton splitting amplitude. And so in this sense, it's kind of, so that tells us the singularity when two positive helicity gravitons, we take their null momenta to become collinear. We get this singularity, at least in a tree amplitude. Okay. So as I said, this algebra is not deformed in self-dual gravity if we just look at the self-dual gravity amplitudes. And the deformation Kevin and Natalie found was for amplitudes in the presence of a local operator. But of course, we run into a problem, which is that there are no local operators in gravitational theories. So it's not quite clear what the generalization of that will be. The next best thing is an infinitesimal deformation. So what I mean by that is I deform the action to first order. So this epsilon is some infinitesimal parameter by the integral over space-time of some object. And I can imagine expanding in this parameter. And so I'm really just introducing this integrated object once inside the path integral. And I'm allowed to create Feynman diagrams with this object as long as I only use it once. For this to be BRST invariant, this thing, it doesn't have to be this O doesn't have to be BRST invariant, this four-form operator. It just needs to be Durham exact. And if you iterate this, so if we act with delta, you can see that delta of O prime would have to be exact as well for this to be consistent. So you can iterate this process. Each stage you do it, you raise the ghost number because this is the BRST differential. And eventually, you'll get a genuinely gauge invariant local operator, but it will just be of higher BRST invariant local operator. It will just be of higher ghost number. So in this sense, these infinitesimal deformations are the natural analog of local operators. Of course, a particularly interesting deformation is the term I threw away in going from the Palatini action to self-dual gravity. So this is the deformation which, if I did a finite deformation of this type, I get full gravity. If I do an infinitesimal one, it gets me at least a little closer. It's the first step towards going to gravity, and inserting this thing will give me MHV, 1 minus, 1 loop amplitudes, and maybe even 2 loop, 4 plus amplitudes. So that would be a bit more challenging. And then the idea is we can consider amplitudes in the presence of these infinitesimal deformations, and that is the natural counterpart of a form factor. Okay, so now we get to a crucial point. So at tree level, the only non-vanishing amplitude in self-dual gravity is the three-point vertex, which appears in the action. And one important consequence of that is that the collinear singularities of a tree amplitude in the presence of an infinitesimal deformation around self-dual gravity are universal. That is to say, they don't depend on the deformation I do. And the reason that's the case is because when I take the collinear limit of the non-momenta on two external gravitons, the only source of a singularity in a tree amplitude is when an internal propagator goes on shell. And this splits the diagram into a three-point vertex on one side and a tree amplitude on the other. But there are no tree amplitudes in self-dual gravity. So what that means is whatever this blob is, it must involve O. There's no other candidate for what it could be. And in particular, the thing on the left-hand side must be the three-point vertex in self-dual gravity. So this is what I mean by universal. The collinear singularities don't care what operator I deform by. So in this picture, these are the vertices in self-dual, this is the three-point vertex in self-dual gravity. This is the propagator that's blowing up. And these cross dots represent some tree amplitude in the theory deformed by the operator A. I hope that makes sense, because that's a crucial point. All right, so then the claim is that the holomorphic collinear, okay, we haven't quite got to holomorphic. I'll explain what that means in a second. But the collinear singularities of tree graviton amplitudes in infinitesimal deformations of self-dual gravity are described by this sort of extension of the celestial chiral algebra by a kind of adjoint representation. So it's generated again by some tilted versions of the W generators. And its OPs take exactly the same form as we saw for the J tildes. So if I hit them with a W, I just get exactly the same structure constants and get W tildes out. And the idea is this is encoding the tree splitting amplitude, which takes a positive helicity graviton and a negative helicity graviton to another positive helicity graviton. So it's this picture here on the right hand side, where one of them is positive, one of them is negative. These can appear precisely because I'm considering infinitesimal deformations. Right. So then this invites an obvious question. Will this algebra be deformed in the quantum theory? Well, at first glance, you might think it won't be, because it's a very well-known fact that graviton amplitudes, there are no one-loop splitting amplitudes in gravity. But this is only true in the true collinear limit, which is to say when I take the null momenta of one of my gravitons to be actually proportional to the null momenta of the other one. But the chiral algebra actually is telling me about the holomorphic collinear singularities. So that is, I take my null momenta, I split it into a left-handed and a right-handed spin helicity variable, and I take the left-handed variables to become collinear, but I keep the right-handed variables fixed. So in particular, in this limit, the null momenta don't actually become collinear. Only the left-handed spin helicity variables do. The null momenta become, we find that they span a totally null two-plane. So the one-loop all plus amplitudes that are present in self-dual gravity don't acquire new collinear singularities. That's the statement that the chiral algebra wasn't deformed in self-dual gravity. However, in infinitesimal deformations, they will be deformed. And this is well known. In fact, this has mostly been considered in the context of recursion methods for computing loop graviton amplitudes. At least the leading order singularity has been characterized. So it comes from the following diagram. So again, here, this cross dot represents some tree amplitude, if I'm considering a one loop amplitude, of course, a tree amplitude, which involves my infinitesimal deformation. And these two external gravitons are both positive helicity. And there are two sources, singularities, possibly this propagator could blow up, but also there's a singularity in the loop integration. So this little triangle diagram with one leg off shell has been computed, and it's described by what's called the effective graviton vertex, which takes this form, and this p squared 1,2 in the denominator indicates the presence of a simple pole as these left-handed spinner helicity variables become collinear. And if we include the propagator as well, so not just the loop integration, we find that we get a double pole. But crucially, in the true limit, where the square brackets go to zero at the same rate as the angle brackets, because we've got a 1,2 to the fourth, but an angle bracket squared, this will tend to zero. Okay. And then what we can do is we can take this object, which we might call a holomorphic splitting amplitude, and use it to deform a chiral algebra. And in terms of the hard generating functions, this is a very easy thing to do. It just takes this form. And decomposing into soft modes, we find it takes this form. So I've highlighted this factor of 2 over 5 pi squared because this is going to appear again. There's a double pole. The shift by minus 4 means we won't see this until we at least go to generators for which p plus q and r plus s are 4. The reason I've evaluated it as z over 2 is for symmetry reasons, although there will be other corrections. This is just the leading correction. And this factor here, this R4 PQRS over 4 factorial, this is basically completely determined by symmetry. So there's a sort of more general version we can define for any L. So it's intertwining the SL2C representations. But in fact, it's doing more than that. So this SL2C gets extended by a Heisenberg algebra, which contains the super translations. And this object is actually intertwining representations of this algebra. And that fixes it completely up to an overall scale, which is why I've emphasized just the overall factor in front.
Do you expect there to be higher order multiples than the regular? I guess, like, it's not like it stops at one of my
squared. I believe for you, I don't know if you in the audience has been looking at this, and I think we get no, at least in the chiral algebra, the worst is a double pole. There are also simple poles, and there will be corrections at higher loop, so there'll definitely be more than one loop corrections, but I think that they can't be worse than a double pole. Basically, that's because there's some scaling symmetry in probably the twister action, which just scales Z. Okay. So that's certainly not the only one loop correction. This is just the simplest, and leading one. Interpreting what the other corrections are, I'm going to leave for a little bit later, because what we're going to find is this actually doesn't define a consistent chiral algebra. So interpreting an algebra that doesn't exist is maybe not so meaningful. But the double pole can at least be interpreted. But any corrections must take this form just by symmetry arguments. And it's important that we do think about all the possible corrections, because I'm going to check whether the algebra exists, and it could be that some of these other corrections sort of save us. So even if this apparently leads to an inconsistency, some of these subleading corrections somehow contribute in a way which saves us. So as you can see, the double pole appears here, and as we've seen, this constant is not vanishing. All the other corrections here are bilinear in W and W tilde. And of course, there are also actually derivatives of W tilde which can appear, which would come from expanding this out. You'll notice that no super translations or super rotations appear on the left-hand side. That's a general result. It's impossible for any of their OPs to be corrected at any loop order. And this, we could keep on going with this. The only reason I've stopped is because as we go further and further down, we have a product of SL2C representations on the left-hand side. We've got products of SL2C representations which can appear on the right-hand side, and the ways I can map between them become increasingly complicated. Although they will still be constrained by this kind of Heisenberg algebra symmetry, although I haven't completely characterized the possible ways of building morphisms of that type. All right, so I've kind of spoiled this bit, but we now just check, do we obtain a consistent chiral algebra? So if we have a consistent chiral algebra, we'll have associativity of the operator product. And the way we check that is we just take three operators, O1, O2, O3, and we use this fairly standard equivalence of contours, and this will just pick out the OPs in various different orders. And we should get the same thing on either side. So the choice of operators we make are these. These are kind of motivated by some of the, really by twister theory, is what led me to choose these particular operators. And what we find, and it's a totally trivial calculation to do, that the left-hand side is proportional to this tilde W naught naught, but the right-hand side is zero. But we know that alpha is non-vanishing, so we have an apparent inconsistency. You might reasonably object that this tilde W naught naught is central. It's got trivial OPs with everything. And so I could just throw it away from the algebra. But I mean, one of the reasons for including these kind of W naught naught and tilde W naught naught states is that they always sort of live in these towers, because the supertranslations mean they're always obtained from something acting by a supertranslation. And so if you see a failure involving one of these, there'll just be a tower of failures that live above it. And indeed, you can just go away and check that if we had tried it with a slightly different operator, one step up, we'd have got a similar failure, but now it's proportional to a supertranslation. So there's no way of saving it. Okay. So why have we run into this problem? The point is that the collinear singularities of amplitudes in these infinitesimal deformations are not actually universal. And the source of the failure is the one loop all plus amplitudes. So here is an example of a one loop, one minus amplitude, which contributes to the 5.1 minus amplitude in the infinitesimal deformation by this operator, which moves us infinitesimally towards self-dual Einstein gravity. And you can see that as the null momenta on this graviton and this graviton become holomorphically collinear, this propagator will blow up. But the vertex that's appearing here is the thing that we're deforming with. And the reason we can have this is precisely because there's this four-point one loop all plus amplitude, which is non-vanishing. Okay, so how do we fix it? So I'm now going to appeal to twister theory. Now, I appreciate that this is probably going to be too fast. There's been some great lectures by Kevin on twister theory last time. I think they're on Pion. So if you want to learn more about twisters, that's probably the place to start. But I think it's important because this is really how I came to think about this algebra, was thinking about the twister perspective. So Penrose's nonlinear graviton construction relates 4D self-dual vacuum Einstein manifolds to particular three-dimensional complex manifolds which fiber holomorphically over P1. And on the fibers of that, they admit a symplectic form, which is just twisted by some line bundle on the P1. And we say that PT is the twister space of M. And okay, I'm being a bit imprecise because the precise statement requires a few qualifiers, but points on M correspond to rational curves in the twister space, strictly a subset of rational curves if this is really the Riemannian manifold M. And in Euclidean signature, so for a Riemannian manifold, this gives us a non-holomorphic vibration over M. So a point on M, there's a CP1, this is this rational curve above it, and the P1s for any two different points X never intersect. So this provides us with a vibration. So as an example, flat space, that's certainly self-dual vacuum Einstein. And it has a twister space, which is just the total space of the spectre bundle. And if I use holomorphic coordinates on the fibers via alpha dot and this inhomogeneous holomorphic coordinate on the base, then we can write down symplectic form on the fibers of this form. And the reason it takes values in O2 is precisely because this was a non-trivial vector bundles and these took values in O1. Now we're working in perturbation theory, so we're viewing our self-dual vacuum Einstein manifold as a perturbation of flat space. And so we should view our twister space as a perturbation of flat twister space. So we want to deform the complex structure on twister space in such a way that it satisfies all the conditions on the previous page. So an almost complex structure deformation can be determined by a Beltrami differential. That's a 0-1 form with values in the holomorphic tangent bundle. And it'll determine a genuine complex structure deformation if this operator, if this almost complex structure is integrable. So if the Nienhaus tensor vanishes, which is this object. We also want it to preserve the holomorphic vibration over P1 and to preserve the symplectic form on the fibers. And so for that to be the case, we require further that V is Hamiltonian with respect to the Poisson bracket determined by that symplectic structure. And so it can be expressed in terms of some sort of potential, which is just a 0-1 form, which has been twisted in some way, to compensate the twisting Poisson bracket. And if we have a complex structure deformation of this form, the Nienhaus tensor will be Hamiltonian for some torsion-like object. And we can then write down a twister action whose equation of motion tells us that this torsion vanishes, so the Nienhaus tensor vanishes, and we've got a genuine complex structure deformation, a Hamiltonian complex structure deformation, which on space-time will correspond to a self-dual vacuum Einstein fluctuation. And the action we use just imposes this with a Lagrange multiplier. That's what our space-time action did. And we just introduce a Lagrange multiplier field G, which has just been chosen to have all the right form degree and live in the right bundle so that this thing can be integrated. And it's possible to show, so this was introduced by Mason and Wolf, but it's actually incredibly painful to show that this is actually equivalent to the action that we saw earlier on for self-dual gravity on space-time, at least to show it off-shell. But this was first done by Attle in a paper in 2021. And then we, in our paper together with Dave, we did this in a slightly different way as well. So from this twister perspective, the chiral algebra that we were discussing before arises in a couple of different ways. But in this talk, I'm mostly going to be thinking of it as the algebra living on a holomorphic surface defect supported on a twister line. So this twister line is the rational curve associated to some point on my space-time. The coupling between the defect and this theory on the twister space takes the following form. So we just introduce a whole set of operators on the defect, suggestively labeled W and W tilde. And they pair with holomorphic derivatives of my field, so H, G. And the OPEs between the W's and the W tildes are determined by BRST invariants. So I'm going to require that the combined bulk defect system is BRST invariant. And what we'll find is that at tree level, we'll recover precisely the algebra we had before. And to see that, so we want the BRST variation of these, the linearized BRST variation of these two diagrams to cancel. So here, this LX is my defect. And here, we've just drawn the tree diagrams. And the dot here denotes a coupling to W on the defect. And we find that for these to cancel against one another, these operators living on the defect have to have this OPE, which is the one we saw before. And of course, there'll be a similar diagram where one of these is going backwards with a G, and one of these legs is going off the defect and going up here with a G, and that will give me the other tree level OPE. At loop level, the algebra structure will be modified by loop diagrams, and the one most relevant for us is this one. So here, this dot represents a coupling to W tilde. This one represents a coupling to W. And this is going to necessitate a correction to the OPE of W and W. And what we find, we can just compute this directly. What we find by just taking the BRST variation of this diagram, we find it takes the following form. And we get this crucial factor of 2 over 5 pi squared again. And as I said before, this sort of combined SL2C and Heisenberg algebra structure is sufficient to then recover the full the full double pole we got from the one loop effective vertex. And in fact, this diagram, I mean, you can directly interpret it on space-time as what's called a non-factorizing diagram in the recursion literature. So these are the dangerous diagrams which can modify the subleading and leading poles at complexified momenta in one loop graviton amplitudes and Yang-Mills amplitudes. All right. But as I said, we know this doesn't define a consistent algebra. So what's gone wrong? Well, it turns out that this theory on twister space that we wrote down before, this I think I called it Poisson BF theory, it suffers from an anomaly. And because we're in six dimensions, a local anomaly is going to be given by a box diagram. And because we've got a holomorphic theory, everything is chiral. So everything will contribute to the anomaly. Of course, right now, the only thing I have is this field H. H and G, because the kinetic term pairs them. We computed this. You can use index theorems to access this, or you can just compute it exactly, and you find that it's just non-vanishing. And so if this anomaly is present, the twistorial theory simply doesn't exist, and there's no reason you'd expect its holomorphic surface defects to support consistent chiral algebras. It's important to emphasize that on space-time, this is not an anomaly. Self-dual gravity is perfectly consistent as a theory, at least in perturbation theory. It's only an issue in the twister description. And the way I like to think about that is the twister description is making the integrability of the 4D of the downstairs space-time theory manifest. And when you lose that twister description, it's really telling you that integrability is being violated. And in fact, I think the things I'm telling you about this chiral algebra should really be interpreted in this way as well. This is kind of like the hidden symmetry algebra of the 4D integrable theory, and we're literally saying that it's just not associative in the quantum context. So the integrability has been violated. And it's not this on space-time. I mean, you can still write down this diagram, and it's just the 4-point one loop all plus amplitudes. And so it's really the all plus amplitudes which are causing this failure of integrability. And as we saw, those were precisely the diagrams which led to the non-universality of the holomorphic collinear limits of amplitudes in deformations of self-dual gravity. It's a bit of a mouthful. Okay, so it should hopefully be clear how we fix the problem. We just have to cancel the anomaly. And there are a few different ways we could think about doing this. Probably the most natural thing to do would be to couple to scalars, fermions, maybe some gauge bosons, though if we start coupling to fields which have their own gauge symmetries, we'll start introducing new anomalies, which we now need to cancel on twister space, and potentially even on space-time, we might get a chiral anomaly. And if you like Susie, we might throw in some gravitinos. And the condition for the anomaly to vanish is just that if you count the degrees of freedom weighted by Grassmann parity, so fermions, Grassmann odd objects contribute negatively, then we must, if we get zero, this count is the coefficient of the anomaly, and it will vanish. So there are a couple of natural examples where this occurs. It occurs in self-dual supergravity theories. In a regularized sense, it occurs in chiral higher spin gravity. But I really want to emphasize, I mean, it's much, much weaker than anything that those theories have. I mean, I could just take self-dual gravity, and I could couple it to a single vial fermion, and the twistorial anomaly just doesn't care about spin. So it doesn't care if it's a gravitino or a vial fermion. The reason for that is because it's really a totally local anomaly on twister space, but the spin of an object on twister space is stored in like the global, the fact that it lives in a non-trivial bundle globally. So there are other anomalies on twister space which can be sensitive to spins, but not this one. But the problem with all these examples is that this double pole just vanishes on the nose. And so for the remainder of the time, I'm going to talk about an alternative method of canceling the anomaly, which I think is probably a bit less natural. But the advantage it has is that we retain these double poles, and we cancel basically the one loop amplitudes by a tree-level diagram. Yep?
How much supersymmetries on the car do you get if the supergravity for supergravity?
What's...
How many supersymmetries on the car do you get?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about I haven't thought about this, Susie.
Right or left? There is one question. You're a stress tensor, I think. I'll ask that.
There is no stress tensor, no.
Okay, so I've got.
Well, maybe there are ways to get a stress tensor. I think it's important to emphasize that in these cases, although the double pole is zero, the algebra will still be deformed. So all those bilinear terms, they'll all be there. And it's still a non-trivial fact that it defines a consistent algebra. It's kind of remarkable, but it's really relying, from this twisted perspective, it's just coming from the mesh. Okay, and so one reason for focusing on this example is because I'm canceling a tree-level effect against the loop effect, it allows me to check my value for alpha in a third independent way. Okay, so this exotic object that I couple to, on twister space, it's a 2-1 form, which is required to be declosed. I'm not expecting you to make sense of this pretty horrible looking thing immediately. So crucially, there's this covariant D-bar operator here, which includes a coupling to H, and therefore on space-time to the metric. And then there's also this, what I'm going to think of as a counter term, because this is the thing I'm going to use to cancel the anomaly. So this is probably a bit easier to understand on space-time. So eta descends to a scalar field on space-time, more or less. And this action can be shown to descend to this. So the kinetic term, it involves a coupling to the metric, and it's fourth order. So we've got a Laplacian squared, which is pretty unusual. And then this counter term that we introduce, it's kind of got an axion-type coupling where I'm coupling to the Pontryagin class. You might ask how I know it's the Pontryagin class and not, say, the Euler class, but the point is, on the support of the equations of motion of self-dual gravity, the two are the same. And so by a field redefinition, I can move one into the other. So it doesn't matter. So there's an unambiguous notion of a fourth order, well, an unambiguous notion of a gravitational axion in this theory. So then the twistorial anomaly, or equivalently, the all plus amplitudes can be cancelled by just tree exchange of this axion field, as long as I've tuned my coupling constant precisely so that it takes this form. And this relies on, well, in a sense, it relies on this trace identity SL2C. I emphasize this because in the gauge theory case, we also need trace identities of this type. How are we doing? Okay, we're doing kind of faster. Spoke too fast.
Yeah.
So, in particular, the arguments from twister space suggest that if we couple to this object, we've cancelled the anomalies. I should say, it doesn't, here this is just obviously cancelling the four-point amplitude or the anomaly, but in fact you can show that it cancels all the amplitudes. So this theory is kind of a weird theory, incredibly strange theory, because it has no local operators because it's gravitational, and it has no amplitudes because I've cancelled them all. But nonetheless, and in a sense, that was necessary, because I don't know if there's a precise sense. I haven't explored this in a precise sense, but the Kalman-Mandula theorem would say that if you've got an interacting theory in four dimensions, it can't have some interesting infinite-dimensional symmetry. And somehow, what we've done is we've just eliminated all the interesting amplitudes, and that's what's allowed us to have this kind of intricate. Quantum algebra. So the claim is that this theory will admit a quantum chiral algebra which governs the holomorphic collinear limits of amplitudes in its deformations. And I claim that this is a kind of quantum group, which is a bit like the Yangian for the principal chiral model. And there's a sense in which these perspectives are quite similar. So there's this 4D Shun-Simons description of the Yangian. And you can think of the space on which 4D Shun-Simons theory is defined as being a kind of reduced twister space. In the same way, we're studying kind of a holomorphic theory on a twister space, a four-dimensional space. And we're similarly finding, instead of on line operators, on surface, holomorphic surface defects, we get some interesting quantum algebra. And if this was true, we should find that the previously identified associativity failure would no longer be present. Once I include all the various axion states into the algebra and I determine all their various OPEs by looking at the action before, I'm not going to put that on a slide because it's, well, I have it on some later slides, but it's just incredibly revolting and it won't be, I don't think it will be very clear how it works. But you can show, after some pretty arduous algebra, that the associativity is restored precisely if this double pole takes the value it needed to take. And in fact, you can also check some other coefficients. I think I check another coefficient, and we find that they match as well. Okay, so to conclude, I've explored whether the holomorphic collinear singularities of amplitudes in infinitesimal deformations of self-dual gravity define a consistent chiral algebra. Hopefully, I mean, I think this is kind of an odd question to ask. So what I was trying to get across is to justify why that's a natural question to ask. And hopefully that's clear by looking at the motivation from self-dual Young-Mills. So this is true at tree level, but at one loop, the collinear behavior was modified. And we didn't obtain a consistent chiral algebra because the associativity of the operator product is violated. And that failure can be traced to the presence of the one loop all plus amplitudes, which introduce a non-universal behavior in those limits. But from the twister perspective, the chiral algebra lived on these holomorphic surface defects, and we found that this associativity failure could be attributed to the presence of an anomaly on the space. The twister description just didn't exist if the anomaly was present. And we found that cancelling the anomaly, or equivalently cancelling all the one loop or plus amplitudes, cured the previously identified associativity failure. Right. So where to go from here? So can we understand these objects better? Probably the axiom coupled theory isn't the best place to start because its OPEs are absolutely horrendous. Probably the simplest example is for n equals 1 self-dual supergravity. And actually, maybe Kiyu already knows what that algebra looks like, or formally can at least, in principle, it can be computed, even if in practice it's not so easy. In the case of self-dual Young-Mills, there was this correspondence between local operators and conformal blocks and form factors, chiral algebra correlators. I've kind of argued that the right analog of a local operator is an infinitesimal deformation of the theory, and that in fact this corresponded to a local operator of high Gauss number. And I've argued that the analog of form factors are amplitudes in those first order deformations. But I don't know what the right analog of these objects are. I don't know what a higher Gauss number conformal block would be, or how to make sense of its correlators. But in principle, it should be possible. I mean, these amplitudes should be essentially completely determined by their complex, their holomorphic collinear singularities. That's basically the basis of DCFW recursion, more or less. And so I think it's very, very hopeful that we can leverage this to actually compute amplitudes. And then there's a couple of more speculative things. So here I was talking about Poisson BF theory on twister space. There's a related theory called Poisson Schön-Simons theory, which is not one loop exact, and is a little bit more mysterious. I say it's conjecturally describes the n equals 2 string on space-time. There are some questions there. And also, I mean, I say, what is its chiral algebra? Well, at tree level, I know what its chiral algebra is. It's just this algebra of the W's. But Poisson Schön-Simons suffers from the same anomaly as Poisson BF theory, but I don't know how to fix it. So I have no idea how to cancel the anomaly. And the n equals 2 string doesn't seem to have any object which plays that role. So this is kind of mysterious, quite what the connection should be here. And recently, there's been this remarkable holographic duality in this work of Kevin, Natalie, and Atul. And it's a holographic duality behind a kind of self-dual theory on Born space, a kind of curved, asymptotically flat background. And there's the dual theory is a 2D chiral algebra. I hope that there's a self-dual gravity counterpart. If there is, I expect it's probably tied into the story up here, and I'd love to understand that a bit better. Right, well, thank you very much for listening. It's your time. If you've got any questions.
As I remember, the one loop all plus supergravity amplitude for n equals 1 vanish.
Absolutely, yeah. So this is.
The anomaly is gone, and the associative rule for your chiral algebra should be satisfied.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. It is. This is why the simplest example is probably...
Then it becomes trivial.
Pardon?
Then it becomes trivial.
It doesn't become trivial. The algebra still gets quantum corrected. There are these bilinear terms still appear, and it's still non-trivial that it's associated. The double pole, the leading double pole, isn't present.
So out of curiosity, can you try to define the generators to include like bilinear terms in it? Kind of like if you look at Laurent's paper, he has a series of multi-particle states in it.
Oh. So yeah, is it possible to could it be that the algebra is actually the same after a nonlinear field redefinition of that type?
Exactly.
It could be. It could be. I don't know. It could be. That's a good question. I mean,
it's not the 5 in case, right? The affine Yangian is not a universal nonlinear algebra. There's no field redefinition.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the supersymmetric cases is that all the 1 minus and all plus amplitudes vanish, which is kind of a bit unsatisfactory. So I'd like to say something like there's a specific amplitude we can look at and we can see that its collinear behavior is modified. But I guess in the supersymmetric cases, that's harder to say. But maybe in some other examples, we could see these corrections in amplitudes themselves. I don't know. Maybe there is a nonlinear field redefinition. I don't know.
A little bit confusing. What kinds of amplitudes in your calculation would you manage?
Sorry, I couldn't quite hear that.
What kinds of amplitudes in your calculations are managing?
So, in order for the algebra to be associative, we just require that all the one loop or plus amplitudes vanish.
Okay. And how about, is there any other amplitudes?
In self-dual gravity, there are no other amplitudes.
Okay.
But the algebra describes amplitudes in infinitesimal deformations around self-dual gravity.
Could you say a few words about the finite deformations?
Well, okay, so when I say infinitesimal, I really mean first order. And if you do the first order deformation towards Einstein gravity, you can compute amplitudes, certain amplitudes in Einstein gravity. So the MHV amplitudes at tree level, the 1 minus amplitudes at one loop, and the and I guess in principle, the all plus amplitudes at two loop. I'm not claiming that I can compute them right now, but I hope that these kind of ideas would be useful in understanding those better. It's also, so that was just one particular local operator. One particular deformation. There are others we could consider. In the Yang-Mills case, you can, instead of taking a B-squared operator, there's kind of a B-cubed operator, which is known to be related to the NMHV amplitudes. Hopefully, there would be something like that that exists in the gravitational case. And another interesting deformation is to remove the kinetic term for the axion. So if you do that, you stop the cancellation that occurs for the one loop or plus amplitudes, and you'd be able to hopefully compute the one loop or plus amplitudes. So there are a range of different deformations you might consider and get different amplitudes. Yeah.
Okay, one more question. So you introduced this axion coupling. Do you know what that corresponds to in space time? Do you introduce extra axion field in space time or not?
Yeah. So it just corresponds to adding a new field on space-time, which is this fourth order gravitational axion, I call it. So it's got this fourth order kinetic term. It's got this axion coupling, and I guess in the chiral algebra, this contributes and contributes new states into the chiral algebra. So
okay, so the axion is in space-time.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, exactly. So this is the action on twister space. This is the easier thing to guess. This is the action on space time.
Okay. Are you able to recompute the all plus amplitudes in the axion exchange? I forget if you did.
We've got to the 4-point amplitude. So the chiral algebra. So the chiral algebra involving the axion, it gets all these new states. these E's and these F's, and this is how they couple to the defect, and these are all the OPs of the algebra. And crucially, actually, it turns out that this object here, you can go away and check, and that is basically precisely what will give you the one loop rule plus graviton amplitude at 4 points. The higher loop ones, yeah, I was still working on. Yeah, I don't know. And of course, it gives you it with a factor of 2, because the axiom can still propagate through the loop. But in principle, they should be determined by recursion, true-level recursion.
If you just study it on space-time and study, naively study the Feynman diagram on space-time with an axion exchange, does that?
So I guess in this paper with Dave and Attle, we show that they do all cancel on space-time.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so they do.
So you do have a new proof of this result.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah, I guess you using the chiral algebra, you can compute the 4-point amplitude using the chiral algebra, and then on space-time, the tree-level recursion works. Should work in the chiral algebra, but yeah, I think formalizing that, I wouldn't say that we really proved that, but in principle, it can be done. Thanks for coming.